wanted to know why we have midterms all together in the same week, and the answer is they wouldn't be midterms otherwise. Midterms means the middle of the term. In a 10-week term, that must be around 5 or 6. In this course, the midterm actually comes during the finals week for the other courses. Because this is a 2-quarter course. The middle of the course.
As far as the diagnostic quiz is concerned, you will get that tomorrow. That will be a closed book, closed notes, closed internet, closed person quiz. And it will be due on Monday. We haven't decided yet whether it will be due on Monday at the beginning of the workshop or Monday at noon. Let's see. It will be some problems, cases that have to deal with things we've been dealing with. They have more than enough time to do it. Give it back, sit down, and do it. Read the questions, and ask what you know, and ask what they said, and laugh, and do it again. Find out what you know and don't know. One of the nice things, of course, about having it as a take-home is that you are perfectly capable if need be to have some cookies and tea while you drink that, a glass of wine,
cheese, crackers.
How can it be a closed notes? I'll tell you one. Because you take your notes, you say, okay, I'm ready. And so you worry about yourself, and you let other people worry about other people. At the bottom of the first page of this, there's a statement that you sign that says that I have followed all the rules, and I have used more than time allotted. So if in fact I find out later, for one reason or another, that you did not follow the rules, and that you did have an open book and looked at the internet, things like that, then you're done at this institution, as far as I'm concerned. When you should take them. The quiz is closed. The quiz is folded over, and it's got a seal on it. And so you decide when you're ready to take it, and then you sit down. And I would highly recommend that you don't wait until midnight Sunday night or 8 o'clock, 6 o'clock Sunday, Monday morning. But then you sit down and say, okay, I'm ready. And I guarantee you that from past scores of such things, if people actually spent a lot of time reading the book after they looked at the exams, they did far worse than they would have had they just sat down and do the thing because they're looking for answers. They're not going to find answers in the books. Generally, if I give you a certain amount of time, if I've designed the exam or the exercise for what I think should take you half of that time. So I'll either give you two or three hours, and it should take you an hour and a half.
Any questions?
It's a silly question, Amy.
Why is it called a diagnostic?
It's called a diagnostic quiz because I do my very best on this quiz to ask you about things in ways that we haven't necessarily talked about in class. And my goal is to find out not what you know, but what you don't know, so that I know what needs to be addressed for the rest of the quarter.
Is it so for us to study for it? Would it be appropriate to kind of study for it similar to how the homework problems were
placed?
Yep. Okay.
If you expect it to take us an hour and a half and maybe a max of 3 hours, and you don't want us to use notebooks, other people, why are we doing it in class?
For two reasons. One reason is that you have a midterm and a quiz tomorrow. Okay? And so I think that it would serve us just as well if you could just choose your time and relax and do it, and I'll get a better estimate than if you were all stressed out with a bunch of other things. The other reason is that you'll notice that we're a little bit behind the schedule, and so that'll allow me tomorrow to do things that you'll have fun doing and help us get back to schedule. So tomorrow, one of the things that we're going to do is cut up some calf hearts.
Really?
Yeah. Because this is not an exercise that's really a testable exercise. I mean, doing what you do as students, you're going to look at this line on the heart and that thing on the heart, and you say, this is this, and this is this, and this is this, and this is this. Okay, this is this, and this is this, and this is this. Okay, I think I got enough. This is this, and this is it. The purpose of the exercise is for you actually feel, because a lot of you, especially the vegans among you, don't really realize what fresh tissue looks like, it feels like, as opposed to your cadaver. So that's one thing. The other thing is to give you an idea before we actually start doing things with the heart of what the anatomy looks like and the differences between the left side and the right side and how strong or flimsy, whichever, those valves. So it gives you much better feel for what we're going to do and give you some idea that, gee, maybe this can change its compliance and other things like that. Sean, we got to get into class on time. Generally, what people... Well, I'll give you the classic example. Okay? A number of years ago, we had a final exam that was open looking for. Bring any resources you want. Okay? And I'm the person who doesn't really think that time constraints should be a real major factor. Because in life, you don't have those kinds of factors. So this guy came in with a stack of books. Maybe that high. This was a 3-hour exam, so it was designed to take about an hour and a half. This high. And so he opened up the exam, he's a real excited guy, he's really, really studious, he's going to do this right. He opened up the exam. He looked at the first question, and then he went to his books and he started looking for the answer. And then he looked at another book for the answer. 6 hours later, after everybody had been done for about the last 3 hours, I said, you know what, I think it's time for you to be done. Oh no, I just got one more. And he didn't do all that well because what you're used to doing in a lot of settings, in a lot of exams, is you're used to hearing a story. And your expectation is I'm going to tell the instructor back a story that he told me, or she told me. And so, certainly, if it's worded in this way, I should be able to find those words in the text. Only, well, what's our goal? What are we learning?
No.
To use the information. Okay? So if you sit back and think about things for a little while and say, what makes sense to me? What do I think? Then you do a whole lot better. So give an open book a test. The only reason to use the open book is to confirm whether you're right about something, but you already have a preconceived idea of what you're doing. And sometimes for those, I will let you, but you don't have enough material yet, I'll let you take your models and on a two-sided piece of paper, make that first, and then use that as your resource. Depends on the exam. Other questions? There are no other options, because you have to realize that these come from a slaughterhouse. If they weren't used by us for this purpose, they would be used for dog food or hot dogs or other kinds of things. So nothing is killed or sacrificed specifically for this purpose.
Let me ask you.
Well, you know what the other thing that you're supporting is your own learning about what tissue deals with. And in fact, when you come to your patients, you put your hands on them. It seems to me it would be nice to have some idea that they're going to be something.
Do we need to wear gloves or anything?
Everything will be here. Okay? All right. So, let's see. Any questions about muscle stuff? You might realize now that we haven't talked about every little thing that's in the learning guide. I would suggest that you use the learning guide as a learning guide and deal with the whole learning guide and not just the pages we talk about. The thing that we didn't necessarily mention with respect to skeletal muscle, I don't think we mentioned, and the ligamentated channel of the neuromuscular junction of the motor entry is that the neurotransmitter to the neuromuscular junction or to the motor endplate is acetylcholine. And unlike our discussion about receptors, acetylcholine must be removed from those receptors. So there's an enzyme that lives down on that part of the membrane called acetylcholine esterase. And so the acetylcholine stays on the ligand, stays on the receptor until it's removed by acetylcholine esterase. So one of the things you might want to think about is what happens if there's not enough acetylcholine esterase? What happens if there's too much acetylcholine esterase? And the homework problem will help you address some of these issues.
What percentage of acetylcholine esterase is fueling
I think the thing that stimulates the acetylcholine esterase to remove acetylcholine is the presence of acetylcholine on the receptor. It's something in that protein that activates. Questions? Okay. We're ready to move to the next topic. Now, why should we worry about the next topic right now? What is the next topic? The next topic is cardiovascular system? What? Sympathetic nervous system. Is that all the topic is? Is it sympathetic nervous system? Autonomic nervous system. Okay. And why do you think we should even talk about it right now?
Because we're going into the cardiovascular system.
Because we're dealing with the cardiovascular system and it's involved in the cardiovascular system. Do you think that we should have a discussion that goes through all of the aspects that we'll ever need to know about the autonomic nervous system?
No. We're sure.
So the kid here who's so stressed out because she has this to worry about, that to worry about, thinks that we should actually deal with everything that we'll ever have to worry about. Maybe this is part of the stress. No, we don't have to do that. How many people have heard about the autonomic nervous system before? How many people have never heard about the autonomic nervous system before? How many people didn't raise their hand? Okay, I just want to make sure that you're all capable. How many people anticipate hearing about the autonomic nervous system? Oh, maybe a minimum of 65 to 80 times this year. So why should we talk about it? Because what? don't know if it's number one. Didn't she hear about she had talked about that in anatomy yet? She talked about the central nervous system. Histology. Yeah. Well, the reason to talk about it right now is to give you an overall framework to reference what you know about it and anticipate what's coming. Because what happens, you see, is we talk about the autonomic nervous system here, and then talk about anatomy, and then we talk about the next quarter here. We talk about anatomy, talk about histology, talk about all kinds of other places. And then spring quarter comes, and we're in neuroscience. And people say, you know, I don't understand this autonomic nervous system stuff. That's something I have never really been able to understand, because there isn't that much to understand. There isn't that much. So we wanted now just to kind of get an overview of general characteristics, find out why things are called the way they are, correct a misconception that most people have because of their 8th grade biology teacher, or the 8th grade English teacher who decided to teach biology that day. Because tell me about what the autonomic nervous system does. Controls involuntary actions of like heart, small intestine, large intestine, okay? Like arms and legs. Yes? Yeah? No. Okay. Why not? The vessels in it, remember? Just the other one. Which other one?
Somatic.
Oh, because the somatic nervous system does that. Okay, so what you're telling me is the autonomic nervous system doesn't have much to do with skeletal muscle. It has to do with smooth muscle and cardiac muscle. Anything else?
Circulation.
Well, circulation, how?
Smooth
muscle and blood vessels. Okay, what else?
Glands.
Smooth, what?
Glands.
All right, glands. All right, so now, if you think about the autonomic nervous system, and you think about deals with involuntary kind of things like that, and smooth muscle and cardiac muscle and glands. What are the components that you think of? Parasympathetic and sympathetic, okay? And anything else? Now don't pick up words, say word. You said there are two divisions to the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic and parasympathetic. And I said, are there only two?
Yes.
Yeah. Depending on how old you are. Because if you're your age, then there are three. There's the sympathetic, the parasympathetic, and Kelly said that they do something with the gut. There's also the enteric nervous system, which is also the voluntary nervous system. We'll come to at the end of next quarter. And that's one division. So, what is the sympathetic nervous system? What do you associate with the sympathetic nervous system?
Fight or flight.
It gets activated whenever a bear comes into the house.
Yep.
Is that right? You see the bear, or you're out in the woods, you know, and you're very gingerly walking. And then from behind a tree, there's the bear. What's wrong with that? You don't often run into bears, but lots of times nowadays you run into similar situations with people, running red lights.
Throwing anatomy midterms.
All kinds of things. What's wrong with that assessment? What's wrong with that idea?
Looks like there has to be a really big stressor to make it work.
Or the only time it works is when there's this big stressor. Is that the case?
No.
The sympathetic nervous system is always working. What is the parasympathetic nervous system? Rest and digest. Okay, well, I have these magic words, rest and digest.
Tend and befriend.
Pardon?
I've also heard tend and befriend.
Tend and befriend.
And feed or breed.
Feed or breed. Oh, but you know what?
I know, that's not exactly right.
You can't breed without the sympathetic nervous system.
True.
And in that context, what's the interrelationship between the two systems? They oppose each other. So the picture that you get, here's the picture that I got. Education wasn't the same as when I was young as it is now, so we learned about this at sixth grade. I got the impression that there was a sympathetic nerve going to someplace and a parasympathetic nerve going to someplace, and somehow they blocked each other. Is that an accurate picture? No. Sympathetic nerves generally go to some places, and then they some places, and the parasympathetics go to other places, and then they other places. Sometimes they both innervate the same place, but not often. And they are not always antagonistic. Sometimes they both have to be working appropriately to complete whatever function that you're talking about. Sometimes they both innervate the same place and end up stimulating the same things in different ways. So keep that in mind. And somewhere in the textbook. And, in the learning guide on page F3, there's this huge long list of stuff that this does. Huge long list. And it says effector organ, and it says receptor type, and it says adrenergic impulses and responses. What does adrenergic mean? What is the adrenal secrete? Adrenaline. But it only does that. In the United States, it does something else. Epinephrine. What's the difference between epinephrine and adrenaline? Spell it. And is there another thing that comes to mind when you think of adrenaline? Norepinephrine, nor adrenaline. And in my mind, what I think about this, not strictly true, but in a simple model, it works great. Norepinephrine is a neurotransmitter. Epinephrine is a hormone. And we'll see that the adrenal medulla secretes both norepinephrine and epinephrine, but not predominantly. And you'll notice that by those receptors, there are a whole bunch of different kind of receptors. It says alpha, beta 1, beta 2, alpha 2. It doesn't say alpha 1. It should say alpha 1. And then there are some non-alpha, non-beta receptors. And we're not going to concern ourselves with those right now. We'll worry about a couple of those in a couple of weeks after it makes sense that we should think about it. But what do you get? What is the impression that you might get if, in fact, there is something called an alpha receptor and a beta receptor, that they're both adrenergic receptors?
That's also that parasympathetic.
Then both of the parasympathetic and sympathetic contribute. Maybe. It's a good idea. We'll see that it doesn't work out too well. Anything else? different responses depending on which receptor it is. Yes?
I was offering this earlier, but I think maybe the alpha receptors have to do with being able to maximize output for one receptor, and betas only have one receptor equals one output.
Oh, that's a neat idea.
That's not my idea.
That an alpha receptor is a maximum response and a beta receptor is not necessarily a maximum response. But what you want to think about actually is something we talked about receptors before, and that is, what determines the action of a ligand? And Rochelle says that it's the receptor. It's not the ligand, it's the receptor. It's the receiving cell side where the action is actually determined, not with the potential of the end. So what this tells you is, it looks like cadrenergic responses are all kinds of responses, and what you see is that in that I, it says contraction and relaxation. How can the same neurotransmitter or the same hormone do both? The answer is that the receptors are different. You're taking a different piece of the molecule, and that receptor is determined by the receiving cell. Okay, so we'll come back to that later. If that's the case, what does cholinergic mean?
Acetylcholine.
Alright, and so if in fact you look here and it says SA node, and it has an adrenergic receptor and a cholinergic receptor, what do you think is a major neurotransmitter in the parasympathetic nervous system? The choline. Alright, that's good. Okay, so with that, let's look at this picture. And now I want you to tell me, that's the picture that's on page F2. Tell me what you see. Oh, let's start at the top. What do you see? The central nervous system. Okay? What else do you see? At the top.
Parasympathetic system.
Parasympathetic system. All right. Okay. And where do these nerves have the origin?
Parasympathetic
are in the central nervous system, but the sympathetic are in the central nervous system. Oh, well, fine. I didn't ask about the second one. I asked it because there's a second one over here, and there's also a second one over here. That one's little. All right. Okay. So what Kelly has noticed very astutely is that the postganglionic fiber in the parasympathetic nervous system is short. And the preganglionic fiber in the parasympathetic nervous system is long. Whereas in the sympathetic system, it looks, in this case, that they're about equal size. Except this one's a little bit longer. But in fact, then, if I look at the postganglionic, why is this called postganglionic fiber?
After the ganglion.
It's after the ganglion. What's a ganglion? The okay. Connection outside central nervous system. Another word for that little thing there is a
synapse.
Yes. Now, I guess it might be nice to have some sort of rationale
because I know that you guys love to memorize, but I can't do that. Have some sort of rationale as to why the parasympathetic nervous system might be called the parasympathetic nervous system. From that picture, what rationale could you give? Of what? She says it's at the periphery of the central nervous column. So what does para mean? Means a what?
Around.
Does it mean around? What does parasympathetic mean? If you believe that, what does parasympathetic mean?
Around
the sympathetics. Where are the sympathetics? In the thoracolumbar region of the spinal cord. Oh, you know what? In the parasympathetics are above and below. Part of the what? Part of the nervous system, which? Sympathetic. And what is it like? Yeah, but what is it like in this picture?
A donut.
Like a donut? Yeah. With sprinkles. With sprinkles. I prefer maybe that it might be instead of a donut. Maybe it's a bagel.
Oh, you have salt and cheese.
Where does it occur? In the synapse. So what's happening right here? Synapse. Okay, what did you call a synapse right here?
A ganglion.
Okay. So what is the adrenal medulla like? It's a post-ganglionic structure. Because it plays the same role as the postganglionic cell. And what I'm looking for, you'll notice, is not how things, what I'm always looking for, is not how things are different, but how things are the same. And if I can make a connection about how things are the same, then I have a piece of time so I don't have to make it. Well, I will tell you that the neurotransmitter of these synapses, boom, 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 and these synapses, boom, 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 oh, because here's the sympathetic, the cell bodies of the preganglionic fiber of the sympathetic nervous system. They have in the thoracic, mostly the thoracic region of the spinal cord, in a region called cell bodies. And the cell bodies for the parasympathetics are above and below.
And
so they're around it. The neurotransmitter at the preganglionic or in the ganglion, the preganglionic, from the preganglionic fiber to the postganglionic, and both the sympathetic chain and the parasympathetic fiber, their chain is acetylcholine. And you will find in time that there are more than one kind of acetylcholine receptor. There are nicotinic receptors.
I have a question.
Yep.
I have a question.
Yep.
So, the sympathetic chain, the dotted line that's around that, I'm not exactly sure what that signifies.
Oh, okay. Because you haven't gotten that far yet in your cadaver. But outside the spinal cord, there is a connected group of cell bodies that you can identify. And there where all the ganglia are, and those are all sympathetic, and so it's a sympathetic chain ganglia. And you'll see that when you get to that part.
Why in this part, at least in the sympathetic nervous system, does it involve ganglions in part of it and not in the other part of the
body? I mean, right here it goes through, and there's a ganglion here that's
kind of
not in there.
Post the dotted line.
That's right. And because that's basically... those nerves actually go through, and there's a ganglion over here that's a sympathetic ganglion. So it's an exception to the chain ganglion.
Okay.
But you will find right there, that's one of the landmarks that you can look at when you look at the thorax, next at the nervous system, next to the spinal cord. You'll find this group that's all arranged as a chain. Okay, other questions? Is there any need to do this any further? Do you have any burning or smoldering questions about the autonomic nervous system that we should address at this time? The difference between the pre and the post. What you have to remember is that in general, the presynaptic fiber of the parasympathetic is long, and sympathetics is shorter. Okay, the neurotransmitter in all the ganglion sites is acetylcholine. The postsynaptic fibers are generally for the sympathetic system long, and for the parasympathetic system short. And the neurotransmitter in the sympathetic system is norepinephrine. In the parasympathetic system is acetylcholine. Norepinephrine. Acetylcholine. Except, of course, in those places where the sympathetic neurotransmitter of the postganglionic fiber is acetylcholine. We're not going to worry about it a whole lot, unless you want to sweat. And we'll worry about it. And depending on what kind of animal you are, just go one way or the other. Not going to worry about it. So you want to write that down.
Why is there a difference in the axon?
Because God made it that way. I know, but that's the answer I have to give. I don't know why. So this is an observation that the anatomists made years and years ago and said, oh, look at all these. All these are longer than all these. Let's call all these something and we'll call these something else. And then when the biochemists came around, the pharmacologists came around, and all those things, they said, oh, look at that. There are some other things that are consistent with that division. And that is that the neurotransmitter, the little things that it's different over here than it is over there.
But we don't know.
I don't know that you're ever going to know.
some evolutionary advantage, I suppose. Or there may be something embryologically that makes more sense that way.
So are there structural differences in the wings of the close natural fibers what leads to the difference in the functioning?
Oh, what is it? What is it that leads to the difference in the functioning between the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system? The receptors where? On which cell? The question was, what is it that leads to the difference between actions of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system? You said the receptors on the cell. Well, like what? What are you picturing? Okay. So what she pointed to is these cells, and those cells. So which cells are those? Those are the target cells. Right? They're the cells upon which the cells that are innervated by those nerves. And so the receptors determine the action. Anything else?
Can you repeat what you said with the neurotransmitter for the postganglionic? Like the norepi is for, say, parasympathetic, and then...
No.
Norepi was for sympathetic.
Say sympathetic.
And acetylcholine was for
parasympathetic.
Okay. Anybody else? Now anybody need to know how to spell sympathetic? Okay. Para really mean around?
Para means a resource.
Two paradox. Para eggs, two eggs. Para shoes. So now you have some overview to think about. We're going to come back to this over and over again. So the next thing we're going to deal with, let's talk about what we're going to deal with. And then we'll take a break and talk about it. And then we'll come back and do it. And for those of you who have problems with the lightsaber, boy, you really have problems with it. You know, the reason that you have problems with the lightsaber, I believe, is that you decided that we must be talking about something biological. So I'm going to try to remember what I know about membrane potentials and find the pieces that the lightsabers represent. Find the pieces the boys represent. Find the pieces the girls represent. And in doing that, of course, you ran into all kinds of problems because you had to make it more complicated than it was. The idea is if you don't know anything about membrane potentials and you see that boys move across that fence by a boy gradient and girls move across by a girl gradient, they all happen to have lightsabers, it creates a third gradient and everything drops out and makes sense. So what you want to do is simplify the world first about familiar kinds of things, and then say, how does this relate to things that I know about already with respect to a specific system? So, you're going to have a task, and we'll have the board divided up into sections for each group, probably about 8 or 9. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 8, 9 places. You get together in groups and you're going to design something. So what you want to do is think about a closed circulation system designed to deliver material to a number of destinations based on your current needs of that destination. And so here's the game. Seymour Fish is a naturalist entrepreneur. And he has a design for a new tourist attraction. He proposes to open a facility with 6 large aquarium tanks. Each
each tank will be filled with water, stock position of other aquatic life, and sealed. So there may be some crabs in one, and sharks in another, and whales in another. I'm not necessarily saying what size the tanks are. Okay. And then they're going to be sealed. So there needs to be something to circulate water and nutrient through it. So each tank will be filled with water, stocked with fish, or other aquatic, and then sealed. To provide his specimens with oxygen and nutrients, he wishes to install a closed system that delivers oxygen-rich and nutrient-rich water to an exchanger located in each of the tanks. So there's something in the tank that's going to exchange between this, the oxygen and nutrients and waste products between the water passing through and the water in the tank. The exchanger allows movement of gas and solutes from the flowing stream to the aquarium water and also provides a means for moving metabolic waste products from the aquarium tank back to the flowing stream. You don't care how that happens. That's a given. We've got another great design team working on that. And they're going to come up with the answers. All we have to worry about is this generator. After flowing through the tanks, the water in the circulatory system flows through an element in the circuit that serves as a replenisher. We don't have to design a replenisher. That's a black box as far as we're concerned. And what does it do? It removes waste from the water and restores the water to its oxygen-rich, nutrient-rich state. Specifications for the system stipulate that this must be a closed system. The specifications also stipulate that flow to each tank is independent of flow through the other tanks, and that flow to a given tank increases and decreases as the metabolic needs of the aquatic life in that tank increases and decreases. So here's the tank. You've been hired to design a system that will meet the specifications of this water circulation system. Details of the exchangers and replenishers need not be specified in this phase of design. Specify the components of the system and how these components function and design to meet the specifications of the system. And Mr. Fish has called a meeting of the design team to answer the following questions. Any questions about what it is that we're going to do? And I'll give you about 20 minutes to draw a picture of it, and then we'll go around and see what it is that you designed. Questions? Okay, let's take 10 minutes and then we'll talk a little bit.
I don't remember it being as fizzy as the citrus one.
Now it's sort of like fizzy.
Shake it up a little bit.
I shook it.
Yeah, like I shook the hell out of it to try to make it fizzy when I noticed it wasn't.
Yeah,
to see what would happen, and no, it just doesn't at all.
I drank mine at like 11 and
I think it depends on if it's secondary fermentation.
Did you find your answer?
I did. She was going to go on.
And so we figured distensible tubes will help hold gravity. So if they're expanding, then
it would increase flow, right?
Yeah.
So basically, it wouldn't kill the fish when the water's machine.
Yeah. And we did non-distensible tubes so that that.
I'm not sure. Because you want as the water comes, the water comes down and it's in it, and so it'll create like the water coming down creates pressure.
This is a valve. Where is this valve?
It's being dry, but it's
yeah. We know where it is.
It would be right before the tube at the end of the dispenser, from the end of the exchanger.
Here.
That one, yeah.
It's a valve right there.
Yeah.
From the exchanger going in.
Yeah. And what does that do now? It prevents backflow from this non-distensible tube back into the tank. Okay? I'm a little bit concerned about your distensible tubes, though.
Wait, those can be switched around.
Pardon?
We have the idea going, and then we kind of got it the last second. Well, we changed the model.
I'm concerned about whether or not it'll work and all these fish are going to die or not, is what my real concern is here. So, in terms of design, what I've heard so far now is that have a gravity-operated system. It's a closed system. There are six tanks. And at the top here is something or other that is higher than the rest. And so there's a water tank up there. And by gravity, water is going to go down into this tank and all the other tanks. I've heard now that there are distensible tubes on the inside and non-distensible tubes on the outside, but maybe change your mind. So tell me where.
You didn't change your mind?
So let's see what happens here. If we have a distensible tube, on the inflow, what's going to happen? What's going to happen in that distensible tube when flow goes through it? It's going to what? It's going to distend. And how much flow is going to come out down here?
Less flow.
Less flow.
All right, so I've got a problem there. I understand that. Put a little screen there.
Well, okay. That seems to be an issue here. So now you want to make this inlet side is non-distensible and the outlet side distensible. Is that right? And so what happens as the water goes through the tank and enters the distensible part of the tank, the part of the tube? Just kind of distend, and so is there going to be a return back to the central point?
No.
Got some basic issues there. Does anybody else have some other way to move the water around than gravity?
We do.
Pumps.
Who's got pumps?
We don't have pumps.
I
we
see
were
a pump
using
here,
gradients.
Huh?
We were using gradients.
You reuse.
Gradients occurred, and that was what was powering our system for working. So, like, there was a poo gradient and a poo gradient.
What generated the gradient?
The animal.
Well, the animal. How did the animal? This is interesting stuff.
Well, we had a poo gradient. And a food gradient, and so if our
sea cucumber.
If our sea cucumber was eating a bunch of nutrients and then them out, there would be more poo in here than there would be in our tubing going out. And we have a selective membrane that would allow the poo to go through. And so it would go through there and it pulled through. And as it pulled through, as this guy has been eating the nutrients that went in, there would be less nutrients here than in the nutrient-rich membrane. The selective membrane allows the nutrients to go through.
Well, that's very, very interesting stuff, but now you're telling me how the exchanger works. And I told you that I've commissioned a whole different outfit.
Okay, well, forget about the membrane. That's why.
So, in terms of the plumbing, then, how does the water get circulated around?
She's saying by the gradient.
Osmotic.
Because the poo going out, there's water's gonna come in. Bringing the new fresh food and nutrients, and osmotic pressure.
Yeah, I think Dr.
water is
going
to want to go in to dilute the concentration, the solutes, the poo solutes that want to come out.
Wouldn't the water just overflow each tank then?
But it's a closed system, so it won't overflow each tank.
Oh, just be a little bit of pressure.
If you assume that this exchanger is bringing nutrient in. And removing poo, but this is set up as an osmotic generator of some sort. Then the poo continues to accumulate, and the nutrient never gets in because the solutes can't go through the membrane; only water can go through the membrane. So that raises a real dilemma for me.
Did we say that the solutes can't go?
Well, you agreed that it was an osmotic gradient that caused the water to move around.
Okay.
And an osmotic gradient means that water is moving and not solid.
All right, it's a concentration gradient. We're scratching the osmotic.
So again, how does the water move?
Can we have both?
I don't know how you get both.
Just an equilibrium, right?
Yeah, we didn't have to worry about that part.
Well, you didn't have to worry about how the exchanger worked, but it seems that most people worried about how the exchanger worked. I don't know why. What you had to worry about was how the water gets circulated around in this closed system.
Well, in our system, we were saying that the water moved through the nutrients.
Are we allowed to just, install a pump?
Of course you're allowed to do anything you want. You're the designers.
I thought a replenisher was a pump as well.
The replenisher replenishes. It puts new oxygen in and takes out and removes waste from the system and puts new nutrient in. Doesn't say how it works because you don't get it. That's another company. All this stuff is outsourced, you know. This is the modern world. It all went to India. It's outsourced, except for your American ingenuity plumbing. So, you guys have a pump. Tell me about your pump. You only have 3 minutes. Tell me about your pump here. Now, notice that it says pump and reservoir and replenisher all together. Tell me about your pump.
As far as I understand, there's a pump that's constantly running.
There's a pump that's constantly running. Okay.
Yes, pumping water up to the reservoir.
Pumping water up to the reservoir.
Once the water gets up to there, it pumps the water up from the tank to the reservoir. And then the reservoir fills with the nutrients and whatever. And then it goes back down to the tank. Ta-da.
Okay. Who's the leader of this design team? Who's the designer of this design team? Who can tell me what that reservoir, the pump does a little bit better so I can understand?
Well, the pump, the reservoir is replenishing. And it also has a pump.
Okay.
And to vary the flow from the reservoir and the resistance. And the amount of resistance plays in the opposing flow is dependent on the sensor in each of the tanks. You know, the sensors in the nutrients gets
based on the oxygen level or nutrient level or waste level, that sensor causes an increase or decrease in resistance.
The info, how many of you have resistance in your mind?
So, okay, so now if the pump is working, and the resistance, this resistance decreases, then what happens in this region? If the resistance decreases, then what happens? There's more flow. What happens in this area? The water level goes down. Okay? So what happens? Because one of the things that you said was that each of these tanks have to be able to work independently. So it seems to me that if you don't have this reservoir, which is different, I think, than this reservoir. That reservoir didn't have a pump. What is really the, what's the, this reservoir that didn't have a pump was there, it seems to me, to provide a hydrostatic pressure head of water to the tanks. And this reservoir that has a pump, the system that has a pump, is for a different purpose. And what's the purpose of that reservoir? So what she said was the difference in activity in each of these tanks is going to cause a difference in the sensors are going to detect a difference in activity and cause a change in the resistance right here. And so there can be more flow going to this tank than that tank. And the reservoir, having a reservoir there, ensures that there's enough water in the closed system to make sure that all these tanks have water. Does that sound reasonable? That's really neat. Okay, so now what do we have? We have a sensor, and we had a pump that she says was working at pretty much the same speed. And so what's, how is that water going from the reservoir into these tanks? What's causing it to move? Pump is causing it to move, but how does that happen? A what?
Pressure gradient.
Pressure gradient. So what's the purpose of the pump? To generate what?
Pressure gradient.
Okay, so now what you see in here, in this little model, what you see in here is it has four basic, actually five components, not all of which we've discussed. One is it has a pump that's a pressure generator. It has a reservoir that stores, it's a reservoir for the pressure, really. Okay. It has an exchanger and all exchange units. It has some sort of control to control or even regulate to some extent the flow to each one. And the reservoir now takes another role too, because the reservoir is a volume reservoir. So tomorrow we're going to take up those ideas and see how those ideas